I'd like to congratulate you on your 54 years, 51 years, and 51 years, right? You know, when they call me and ask me if I speak to Canada, but you're not saying no to this one, right? And part of the reason is I got my AA start in Leamington. And this group here, this is the original group, right? And I can remember the original group way back. I attended my first meeting in 1959, and I had my last meeting in 1961. But I remember the old timers that started this group and put it together. I could name them, and you people have been around a while, you wouldn't know them. There were Cheyenne, Chaffee, and Hoffman, and Dick McWiggin, and Alan Jeanette, and you know. Yeah. All of those people, they were the ones that kept it together. I mean, I remember some cold nights up there above the Salvation Army where there'd be four people, you know, maybe five at the most. You could put a fold in at any time, but they kept it going, and because they kept it going, we hit that. And congratulations to all of you that kept it going. A group anniversary is very important. I don't think a person's anniversary is very important. I know people are getting old. It's very important I get a cake and a coin and all this. It's a dating program, right? It's nothing to do with the state. So it's not a longevity contest. We're not here to see how long we can stay sober. I came to AA within my 20s. And, there was nobody in their 20s back then. And the first guy I was speaking to me was a guy named Harold. Now, Harold looked like an alcoholic. Harold had a big bubble nose and a big dark face and a huge belly out here. He could have hung this guy out front and said, "Don't let this happen to you during the year." And Harold was up there and he was talking about all the stuff he drank. And he said, "I drank smoke and I drank rubby dump and I drank." I said, "I had no idea what it was." You know, I had arrived at an AA meeting and I didn't know I was at an AA meeting. You know, some people think they tell the story and they do it chronologically and everything is laid out for you. I've never been able to tell my story. I'm coming up on 43 years and I can't tell my story. And the reason I can't is very simple. I was drunk when it happened. I don't know how many people remember me. I mean, these people get up here and they say, "On a Wednesday afternoon, I was with my brother-in-law, I had a red shirt on, we got this car, registration number." I said, "How the hell do you do that? What, do you write it down or something? Keep a journal?" I have no idea what happened. I have no idea. I know that over the years, people have told me, I have people who remembered me as a drunk, and they told me some of the things I did. But you know how people exaggerate. It might not all be the truth. There's a rumor around that I got arrested in Lowell 78 times in 1 year. Now, that's probably not the truth. It was probably close to that, but not. I had my own jail cell. I was a town drunk in Lowell. When you're the town drunk in Lowell, you're in trouble. If I'm like being the town drunk in Shrew, town drunk in Lowell, all the cops, everybody in Lowell, they're Bobby, he's drunk. I remember one time that I was out of South Common, and, it was a nice day like today, and there was a cop there by the name of Johnny Dukeshire, and he come up and he patted me down and threw me up against the car, put my hands in the back of me, put the cuffs on, threw me in the back of the car. I said, "What are you doing this for? I'm not even drunk." He said, "Oh, well, you'll be drunk and I'll save it for you." I go before the judge, I'll tell you how funny my people are. I go before the judge. There's two judges all over the time, Judge Eno and Judge Gallagher. And I go before the judge, and he knew me by name. And he called me by name. He'd say, "Bob." And I was so proud that he knew me. I look around like, they got a wheel there, And then sometimes he asked my advice. He said, "What am I going to do with you?" And I asked him to let me, he never followed my advice. So I came into this program at tender age, I had my last drink, I was 29 years old. And even then, I didn't think I was an alcoholic, because this is the disease of the night. If you're here tonight, please don't betray yourself. You know, anybody else ever here at any meeting, you know, it's not other people's booze and other people's lives and other people's activities that brought you here, okay? It's you that brought you here. You're the one that brought you here, and you must have done something or you wouldn't have shown up here. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic, and there's a good reason I didn't want to be, you know? I like to drink too much, you know, my sponsor once said to me, he said, you know, well, there used to be a guy down in a school years ago, he talked about the cucumber, and he said, you know, you take a cucumber, and you put it in the brine, and it becomes a pickle. And once that cucumber has become a pickle, it can never, ever, 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 ever.
I'm
going to
beat you
up. I'm going to beat you up. You make it away with it, we're all going to pray for you. But the truth of the matter is, see, you know, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought maybe, you know, I had been involved too heavily in drinking the wrong stuff or something. And I thought when I came in here, could you just teach me how to drink, you know? Teach me what I had done wrong, right? You know, I had no idea what social drinker was. I know today that I was an alcoholic from the day I was born. I was never, ever, ever a social drinker. I just never was, you know? And that confused me for a long time. I have married since I got in the program. I've been married to my current wife for about 36 years. And she's a social drinker. And let me tell you something, it's disgusting. It's a little party sometimes and people will say, would you like something to drink? You know that sometimes she says no? I never said no. The only time I said no was when they said, have you had enough? No, I haven't. I'm not going to win. And yet, this woman, it's a true social drinker. When she does get a drink, she'll get one of these tall ones, you know, and there's leaves in it, and flowers, and trees, you know. You know, and if you're sipping it, that's very strong. There's nothing in it. You know, 20 minutes later, there's a cigarette butt floating around the top. You know, she's a social drinker. I was never, so one day I said to myself, I gotta see if I can draw an analogy between what I am and the social drinker, see? Because I gotta find out how social drinkers think. So I did it with wheat. You know, I got up this morning and I had a bowl of wheat. I did not have the second bowl. Or maybe I did. I don't know. It doesn't make any difference. You know, it really doesn't make, I know one thing. When I reach in my pocket over here, I don't have any spare plates to think about. When I go out here tonight and I'm headphones, the dog jumps out in front of me and I slam the brakes on 13 empty wheat spots and will not come out of my seat. See, I can take it or I can leave it. It means nothing to me, nothing whatsoever. But that isn't the way I do rules. Rules was always important to me, always important. I probably was born an alcoholic, and I didn't become one until I picked up a drink, but I was messed up. You know, Lorraine talked about her childhood and her family. I didn't have a family. People talk about that, you know, they come from a dysfunctional family. I had no family whatsoever. I was born in Worcester. I had a twin brother. And we were preemies, and so they kept us in the hospital until we were old enough to walk or something, whatever the hell they were doing. Not walk, but you know. And then they decided to turn us back over to our parents, so they called up our parents, and our parents weren't there. They left the wrong address, they left no forwarding address or no telephone number, so I never knew my mother. I never knew her at all. I never knew my father. I'm not sure my mother knew my father, except for a brief moment somewhere along the way. And we, much the same as Lorraine, I was, you know, bounced from pillar to pillar, you know, in foster homes and so forth and so on. That's not why I'm an alcoholic. That's really not, has nothing to do with my being an alcoholic. One of the things that happened in those foster homes did contribute a little bit towards my being here, though. You know, and it wasn't abuse, and it wasn't like that. You know, I was not adopted, but brought into a foster home, and the people there were Baptist. Now, I understand this is a French Catholic, but see, I want to thank you for letting me in. But I was brought up up there, and we lived on the water down at the time, and we used to go to Tremont Temple down at Tremont Street, And let me tell you something, I had God shut down my soul from early morning till late at night, On Sunday, it was just one, spiritual experience after another. And, we go to early morning sunrise service, and then we go to Baptist Youth Fellowship, and then we go to, back to school, and then we go to the full service, and then the afternoon there'd be another something or other, and then in the evening there would be revival meeting. It was a trumpet player, and what a friend we have in Jesus and all that, And I had just had God shut down my throat. And now, if you wanted to revival me, you had to go down front, if you wanted to be saved. Right? That's the purpose of the whole thing, is to be saved, And I was terrified. But as a little kid, I walked down there, and I stand in front of the altar with 100 other people, waiting for God to enter my heart. And I stand there and I feel nothing. I say, it isn't working. And then they say, if God doesn't enter your heart, you are going to be punished. You are going to die, you are going to hell, you are going to burn. And I was scared shitless. I couldn't believe it. I said, why can't I get God into my heart? So at a very early age, I was full of fear. And my biggest fear of all was the fear of dying, but there were many other fears. And I developed anxiety attacks. I had anxiety attacks in the first and second grade. And I'd be in class and my hands would curl up and my heart would start beating and I'd do the deep breathing exercises. And, I'd ask the teacher, can I leave? You sit right there, Bobby, don't you move. And I was dying. Now I'm in the second grade, I'm full of fear, I'm having anxiety attacks. I'm all messed up. If I had a transparent head when I was 7 years old and walked right down that aisle, you'd say, hey, there's something the matter with that kid. You could have seen it. That's how messed up it was. Now, my second strike against me is my twin brother. My twin brother, and some of you people know, he's been sober now about 21 years. I waited 22 years to get him in the program. He thought he was better than me. But he's educated, you see? He used to rub me, he went to college. He got a bachelor's degree, then he got a master's degree, he worked on his doctorate and all that, And when I was out there drinking, he was teaching school, And he was up there in Holden and Rutland and Paxton, and he was teaching school. And he tried to straighten me out. Of course, he was drinking as much as I was, but he had a child. and he tried to straighten me out. And he said to me, Bob, you've got to listen to me. I have several degrees. I said, so does a freckle thermometer, and I don't listen to that. And he was even a little more formal. The teachers loved him, the people loved him, the parents loved him. And people would always say to me at school, why can't you be like your brother? And I didn't want to be like my brother, but I realized if I was going to be accepted, I had to make an effort to be like my brother. And so at age 8, 9, 10, I tried to emulate my brother. Now, at 7, I'm having anxiety attacks, I'm messed up, I'm full of fear. Now at 8, I'm a phony because I'm not being myself, I'm a phony, I'm a perfectionist because I feel he's perfect and I got to try to be perfect. Am I on my way? I'm on my way. Strike three. We lived down in Watertown. God gave me a gift when I was born. It was a gift of being able to play music. And while we mentioned that, I would like to mention a guy that was a member of this group years ago who was very instrumental in helping out. Another musician, Mick George. He did an excellent job helping me out. He was a trombone player, played with a lot of name bands, the same way I did, so we had a lot in common. And he was there for me, along with Jeanette, when I needed. This group was very important to me to begin. But anyway, not to get out on that thing. I studied with a member of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and I went out on the road playing. If God gave me the gift to play, I don't understand why he didn't give me the gift to get out in front of people. The anxiety and the fear was so great when I was in front of people. And they don't pay for playing the mentor. You gotta get out there on the stage. So I After having several anxiety attacks and so forth and so on stage and made a fool of myself on stage in front of thousands of people, right? I remember one time I was playing with a band that will remain nameless, and we were doing a national broadcast. And I fell and I pulled the plug. We went up to the air, right? They didn't appreciate that. They didn't appreciate that at all. So, after doing all those things, I decided to come back to Massachusetts and get used to working in front of smaller crowds. So it was down there, and I had to train. So it was down in front of these smaller groups of people that one night that I had an anxiety attack on a stage. It was down at an old place in Boston, the corner of Tremont and Stewart Street, and I was playing there. The anxiety attack. If you never had an anxiety attack, you know what I'm talking about, right? And if you have had one, you know it's indescribable. You know, it's a terror attack. It's a terror that comes over you. And it gets worse and worse, and you try to fight it down, and the more you try to fight it down, the worse it becomes. And I was trying to fight this thing, and it got the better of me, and I passed out. I fainted. And I was kind of at the back of the hall, and a bartender gave me a water glass full of corks. He said, "Here, sip this, it'll make you feel better." Now, I know I should take that drink, because I've been brought up a Baptist, and the Baptists say you can have coke, although I know a lot of Baptists. And I knew I shouldn't drink it, but I took a sip of that, because he told me, just sip it. And I took a sip of it, and I remember it like it was 2 minutes ago. And it burned all the way down here, and it got down to about here, and there was a little explosion. And the warmth from that explosion went down into my legs, and it was going around here, and it was coming up around my belly. I could feel the warmth going up into my ears, you know. And with every bit of warmth that was going, all the fear, and all the terror, and all the anxiety was just washed away. And I felt wonderful for the first time in my life. That's why I'm here today. If a woman had done that to me, I would have been a saint. Now, looking back, and hindsight is 20/20 vision, I know that night I took the first three steps of alcoholism. Not the first three steps of AA, but the first three steps of alcoholism. Because they correlate perfectly, right? My life was unmanageable, right? Because I couldn't play, I couldn't do anything because of my fears and this and that. So my life was totally unmanageable. And I admitted it, right? I took the road to go back home to see if I could get my life in order. You know, I had to drink. But that night, you know, I suddenly realized, the second step, I came to believe that there was a power greater than myself that could help me through life. It was called booze. I came to believe that booze would help me. I came to believe that instantly, you know? Holy mackerel, what was that stuff I just had? And coming to believe that, I did the third step. I turned my life and my will over to care of alcohol and drugs as I understood. That's what I did. Now, people come in and they say, "I don't believe in a power greater than myself." Of course you believe in a power greater than yourself. You use the goddamn stuff, he is. You don't think so? Be the first step. First step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Powerless over alcohol. That's what it says right up there. It's just a step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. And if we're powerless over alcohol, that means that alcohol is a power greater than ourselves. And it certainly turned out to be a power greater than itself for me, and I'm sure it did for the rest of the people that come too. It was a power greater than ourselves. And I turned my life to my will over to care. I believe that coming into AA is just a transference of power. You know, we've got to find a different power. Something that won't let us down, something that will stay with us all the time, something we can turn to and learn to live with. But that comes later in my story. Okay, now I'm a drunk. I got drunk that night. I got up the next morning. I was very, very sick. You know, I went out and I bought a half a pint of Corby's. That's what he had given me the night before. That was the magic elixir. I took the cap off. I threw the cap away. I had no intention to put the cap back on the bottle. Why would I put the cap back on the bottle? And I drank, and it worked just as good at 9 o'clock in the morning as it did at 9 o'clock at night. And then my journey for alcoholism started. Now, I won't go into a lot of story because I want to talk a little bit about recovery. But I will tell you this, by the time I got here, I've been arrested, hospitalized, institutionalized, locked in, locked up, locked out. I get my house running, how do my house running get in? I had to stay just west to drive east to west, east to DC to Harvard. I was covered with wine stores from head to foot. My money was gone, my family was gone, my self-respect was gone, my career was gone, my teeth weren't there anymore. I was living in a hoopla box over on 8th Avenue Road. I spent 18 months in that hoopla box. It wasn't like they got now. See, the hoopla box is now. You know, they really screwed things up for you. Now you got to climb up that little ramp and slide in. They didn't have a cover, they didn't have a cover up, and I lived there. I lived in a little box, and I lived there, and someone went over there one night, and somebody was in there. And he was bigger than me, he said, true, and I said, I don't remember the things that happened to me. I know I worked on the road for a while, I was down the road, I know I got thrown out of the business because I never was where I was about to. The band would be playing in Shreveport, I'd be in Baltimore, you know? I never was where I was supposed to be, and so I came back to Massachusetts, got a job working in honky-tonks down in Boston, and I took day jobs to support my great. First great day job I had was driving a bird truck. And I hit a hybrid in Salem, Massachusetts, and the bird was soggy. And the pies were messy, and the cake was done, and I got fired. And I don't know, I walked for a year, and I got my license back, and I got a job driving a boat truck. And I always said, driving drunk, sitting down, and I was driving drunk, standing up. You know? And if they never go one of those stand-up dipos in the wintertime, they think we, you know, they get very slippery there. There's no need in that damn thing. And one time I was driving on the road and it was too cold, and it was out of control. I could tell him about it, it was spinning around the circle. Back in those days, milk was his last, and I know what happens to glass when he hits something like a tree. And so I just, you know, the scratch is a better part of valor, I jumped out. I landed in a snowbank and nothing hurt but my dignity, you know? And the truck stopped on the road about 50 feet. Oh, my, it was doing a better job of robbing than it was. And I got fired. I didn't get fired for the accident. I got fired because something about stealing. I'm not sure. They say it. I always thought that if the money was in your pocket, it had to be your money. They didn't feel that way, right? So I got fired. Then I went to work for Google Industries. Hired a handicap. And I was the most handicapped person I ever had. And I got fired from Google. Now, when you get fired from Google, I want to tell you the end of the employment life. You go looking for a job, they say, where was your last employment? I worked for Google Industries. Will you be executive director? No, I put the head on the dog. I'm going to get fired. Put a boy head on the door. Next time. Now, somewhere along the way, I wound up in El Paso. I don't know how I did it. I don't even, it had to be the grace of God. We're here, that's for the grace of God. That's the sign. That I had to, I wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? I wound up in a meeting, 1959, I couldn't make it. I tried to make it, I couldn't make it. I tried to make it, I couldn't. If you're slipping around and sliding around, I understand. It's not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing, especially when you don't believe in God, or you know. Finally, I don't know what happened. In 1961, on July 17th, Alan Jeanette picked me up right out here on Central Street in front of the old Y and took me to Marion Johnson. Right? And Marion Johnson let me in. I didn't have any money. Back in those days, it was only insurance. You had to have money to get into a place. You know? And if you had money, why would you go? You know? I mean, little of money's gone, right? But Marion took me in, and I don't know how long I stayed there. And I come out from there, and I ran into a guy by the name of I didn't think I could stay so. And that talked to me about the disease. He said, let me ask you a couple of simple questions. I didn't think I was that bad. I still didn't think I was that bad. You know, but I had dried out long enough up there, maybe 9 or 10 days, whatever, so that my thinking cap was, you know, it was not functioning real good. And he said, with some couple of brain cells where he said, did you know what fear is? I said, I know what fear is. He said, no, not the fear of being scared of somebody, but that fear of the unknown, that little scary feeling that starts and sometimes it blooms. And, you know, fear of impending doom. Do you understand that? I understood that. He said, when he said that, I understood it. And he said, let me ask you this. Do you know what compulsion is? Not the compulsion that they depict in Hollywood, but, you know, compulsive. After you take it to drink, you just can't get enough. And when I look at that, let me tell you what compulsion is to me. You know, you're in a bar, right? It's 2 o'clock in the morning and they're closing the joint. The lights come up at the bartender says, last call. Let me have a double. Give me a triple. Give me 2. You know? I need another drink like I need another armpit, right? But I want another drink. And before I leave, I say to the guy, could you put something in a plain brown bag? And he says, what for? And I said, well, in case. In case of what? In case they don't make anymore, in case that's all they do. Right? Compulsive. I understood that. Right? Talk to me about remorse. Did you ever have remorse? I was in constant remorse. Constant remorse. I was always sorry. I was particularly in remorse when I stood before the judge. You know? I was sorry I did it, and this will never happen again. I promise you, it will never happen again. How about guilt? Did I understand guilt? I did the guilt. I was always either guilty for doing something I shouldn't have done, or I was guilty for not doing something I should have done. But I walked around with a constant feeling of guilt, and people exaggerated. You know, they told me, you should be guilty, you know? My ex-wife was a tour guide for guilt trip. She took her by the head. You know, and so I understood that. How about loneliness, he said. Do you understand loneliness? Not the loneliness of being alone, but the loneliness of trying to function in the world where nobody understands. Nobody understands. Everybody, anybody ever say this to you? What's good in you? Right? They should say that to me on, what's good in you? What was good in you? Well, how about this? Can't you see what you're doing to yourself? Loneliness. No help. They didn't understand. You know? So he said to me, do you understand what I'm talking about? And I said, I do know what you're talking about. And he said, well, you got it then. I said, got what? He said, alcoholism. You crossed over the line. You're an alcoholic. I said, well, what does that mean? He said, you can never again drink in safety. That doesn't mean he can't drink. Right? It means he can't drink in safety. It's like shooting off fireworks in your backyard on the 4th of July. You know? When it's under control, they all go up and they're beautiful. We're different. One goes over there and sets the neighbor's house on fire. One goes over there and sets the police car on fire. You know? It just doesn't work out. So I said, well, you know, this is terrible. What can I do? He said, well, you come into AA, and said, we know the way. We know how it's done. I said, how is it done? He said, stay sober today, and I'll let you know tomorrow. Right? Stay sober today, and I'll let you know tomorrow. He taught me a date of time right off the bat. Harold taught me a date of time. They got me a room above a bar in the wall down on Central Street. Salvation Army paid for the thing. I had meal tickets for 2 meals a day at Rochef Steiner. And I go up in that room at night and I would die. I would die. They came to a meeting. And we went miles and miles to meet, you know. I mean, we didn't have meetings like they got now. I mean, you know, we get the car, I say, where are you going tonight? He'd say, Portland. I said, Jesus, I hope he means Maine. You know? And I get up in that room and I say to Harold, I'm dying. You know, I'm dying. I'm not going to make it. You know, you think this is funny. I weigh 103 pounds, you know. My heart's coming right out of my chest. I'm dying. I'm not going to make it. I use heroin. I mainlined. I use everything, right? And you heroin addicts out there, they tell me it's tougher than it is. That's bullshit. That's all I'm saying. The problem with you, not with heroin. But anyway, to make a long story short, you know, I told him, I said, I can't do it. And he'd say, let me tell you what. If it's just bad tomorrow, I'll give you a drink. And I live on that all night long. You know, I wait for the dawn to come up, see? And Howard would show up and I'd say, have you got it? And he'd say, have you got what? I'd say, have you got the drink? He said, I'm not going to give you a drink. I said, you told me yesterday that if it's just bad tomorrow, you give me a drink. He said, this isn't tomorrow, this is today. Before I came to the realization, you know, he's never going to give me a drink. You know, we do this a day at a time. We do it a day at a time. That's all we do. You know, I know people got anniversaries coming up and this and that. You know, don't worry about it. This is a daily program. You know, I'm coming up on 43 years, another couple of months, you know. And people say, how come you still attend meetings? You know why you still attend meetings? And it's nothing, great thing, anyway, I'm still thinking. Because I'm not staying away from my last drink. I'm staying away from my next drink. And my next drink is right there. And if you see your next drink is not right there, then think of how that point is, right? Because this is the intended tale you heard up here. So here tonight, you're having trouble. We're open 24 hours a day. 24 hours a day we're open. We're open 24 hours a day. We never close. Get the names of the people in this hall that come from the Leominster area out here. Find out who they are. Get their phone number, because the heebie-jeebies come in the middle of the night. That's when the panic comes in. You can pick up the phone. Don't pick up the phone drunk. We don't want to hear you calling us drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning. But if you're sober and you need help, you pick up the phone and you talk to them. And I believe you, they'll talk to you. We'll talk to you. And if you get somebody that doesn't talk to you, stay sober 90 days, get up here and point the sun, they'll get you. Attend meetings on a regular basis. Set up a schedule. And don't say I'm too busy to attend meetings. You're not too busy to go out and get drunk. I picked up a guy one night not too long ago, we're going to a committee, and he said, it's snowing out. I said, what are you, a weatherman? Of course it's snowing out. He said, well, we're traveling all the way over to Derry, New Hampshire. I said, if there was a bottle there and you were drinking, you'd get over there. No question about it. Go to meetings. Don't find excuses. Somebody told me one time, he said, I can't go. He said, I got the runs. I said, I'll grab some extra toilet paper. We'll see you. It's important that you go. This is where the help is. This is where the help is. It's here. This is your medicine. This is God gave this program to drunks, to your people, to pass on. And you must pass it on. You have to. And then the last thing you got to do is have a little faith. So let me tell you a little faith, and I'll sit down. Let me take it back to Lowell probably 45, 46 years ago. I don't know what day it was. It was the middle of the night, that's for sure. But I have no idea. I only know I was sick. I can remember how sick I was. I needed a drink terribly, and I needed something. And I had no money, and I had no drugs, and I had no friends, and I had no booze. And it was late at night, and I was pounding on barroom doors, beating on barroom doors. Please, somebody let me in. I got to get a drink. And finally, instead of wee hours of the morning, somebody opened up the door. They were in there playing cards. And the guy came up and he said, what do you want? And I said, I need a drink bad. I said, can you get me a drink? And he said, screw. And I did the only thing an alcoholic would do. I begged him. I said, don't say that to me, please. I'm out here all alone. I haven't got anything. I'm going to die out here tonight. Don't you understand? I'm going to die. Please. If you've got any compassion, any understanding, please, I'll do anything for you. But please get me a drink. You're my only shot. And he went back inside and he got a fist of booze. And he gave me that fist of booze. It was beautiful, it was golden, it was there, it was mine, And I could feel the panic leaving. The blood pressure went right down, the heart dropped to where it was supposed to be. I suppose a smile across my face. Gonna be a good day. Now what transformed me from a raving maniac to a serene human being? Booze, right? Of course not. I had even taken the cap off the bottle. It was fake. I simply believed the buckets in that bottle would work for me. And because I believed it would work for me, it worked for me. You're here tonight, no wonder that this program works. Believe that what is in this room will work for you. It'll work for anyone. Believe it, and it will work for you. And you get the greatest gift of loving God will ever give an alcoholic. 24 hours of sobriety. Thank you.